Chris Dorner, Badge of Dishonor, Episode 2, The Manhunt. February 2013, a young couple gunned down in Irvine, California.
They were slumped in a car atop a parking structure where they lived in Irvine.
A written manifesto would later reveal the suspect.
This manifesto goes on for 20 long pages. Here it is when you read this thing.
Rogue cop, Christopher Dorner.
We have strong cause to believe Dorner is armed and dangerous.
On a mission to exact his own revenge, feeling he was wronged by the LAPD.
That all of this, his anger, may stem from the fact that he was terminated in January of 09.
Dorner saying he would target LAPD families, their officers, and anyone who got in his way.
Many of those threatened in Dorner's manifesto are members of the LAPD, where he was an officer.
For the next 10 days, a reign of terror across Southern California. He would hide out in a popular ski resort on Big Bear Mountain.
Christopher Dorner has said that he will not be taken into custody alive.
Before making a final run and getting pinned down in a mountain cabin.
Looks like the house is on fire there,
yes.
Kevin.
Yeah, the house was lit on fire.
A brief exchange of gunfire occurred.
We believe that Chris Dorner, the fugitive that's been on the run for about a week, who's gone on a murderous rampage, has met his fate inside this cabin.
Now from the Fox 11 studios in Los Angeles, Hal Eisner, Laura Diaz, Phil Schumann, Pete Wilgorin, and Dr. Carol Lieberman. Chris Dorner, Badge of Dishonor, Episode 2, The Manhunt.
So this was all very shocking that this young couple, engaged to be married, had everything to live for, were found slumped over in their car and killed so brutally.
And I think the interesting thing about that, because I was there, and I think the interesting thing about that was we didn't know what was going on. It was really weird the way the police were acting. It was like they didn't want to talk about what was going on. That's why the news conference happened later. But we all thought, all the reporters that were there thought, this is weird.
Because they knew it was a police captain's daughter, maybe? Or
well, eventually, I think we sort of all figured that out.
But according to
out,
Beck, yeah. He says initially they thought it was random violence. Initially, they did not think it was connected to the LAPD.
Right, and I think that's true. I think I recall that this just seemed to be a couple, and it was random in a nice building. It was a very nice complex.
Do you remember when it was that Evans called and said, check out this connection?
Was
it the next day?
A few days later.
When she learned who Juan was.
She called the police and she said she thinks she knows who the killer is, that it's Christopher Dorner. And then the manifesto, they started examining the manifesto and started, I guess, seeing that this, yes, indeed, obviously, this is Christopher Dorner.
As the fired LAPD officer Christopher Dorner is naming names and what he calls high-value targets, people like LAPD Chief Charlie Beck, former Chief Bill Bratton, just to name a few here, the manifesto posted online on Dorner's own Facebook page.
And they put one and one together, but it took a long time.
But, you know, and then they didn't want to...
Sixth.
They didn't want to announce that it was... They kept it really quiet that it was Teresa Evans who had reported this, because they thought that that would even exacerbate his rage and he would kill more people.
But she never forgot her encounters with Christopher Dorner. She believed him to be dangerous. Seething yeah. with
she
this
anger.
She said
she carried a gun with her everywhere she went. I mean,
so at first, nobody really has a handle on what's to come. They know that they've got a murder investigation, like any murder investigation, and there have been plenty of unusual ones in Southern California. This seemed random. Was it somebody going around killing people, or was it an incident that was isolated? That nobody knew that at that point until the manifesto came out.
But all law enforcement is targeted. You know, this is a vendetta against all of Southern California law enforcement, and it should be seen as such.
What I'm curious about here, what was the reaction of the police when that moment when Chief Beck said, oh, my goodness, what do we have here?
Well, you can imagine that they were in the moment when they started to connect the dots and to realize that Christopher Dorner was seeking revenge against anyone he thought had wronged him. They collaborated immediately. He talks about the fact that they turned one of the rooms there at LAPD headquarters became the Situation Room, where they were all gathered around trying to figure out what to do next and to protect the targets that were most at risk. And this was dozens of people, including Chief Beck's family. So they had to get a protection detail in place immediately. There was no time to spare. That meant in his family, they brought all of his family together under one roof as best they could. That included his children. I think he had one grandchild at the time back in 2013. He tried to get his father there as well, but he refused to come. And actually, officers at a Metro and SWAT were living in the garage there, protecting the Beck family. And this was happening throughout the LAPD. Some people left the area and went to go stay with relatives in other communities. Sometimes they were perhaps put in a hotel, but they were being guarded 24/7 because they had a huge target on their back, and they knew that this particular person, Chris Dorner, had a huge arsenal of weapons and that he was going to use them to try to take out people that he felt had wronged him.
And what a strange situation for those who protect to need protection. What a strange turn of events. A series of shootings in Orange County, L.A., Riverside counties, and one thing leads to another, and the next thing you know, there's a manhunt. And as I recall, being in Corona, being in Irvine, and being in Big Bear, nobody ever kind of felt safe. Nobody was sure what was going on around them. How intense is this search right now? I mean, there are a lot of Los Angeles police officers here in Corona.
Yeah, extremely volatile situation. The suspect is armed and is dangerous and shows the propensity to shoot when confronted.
Is that your recollection as well?
Oh, absolutely. And you remember they shot at the two women delivering newspapers in the early morning. The LAPD officers thought,
and that was because
that
they thought vehicle
it was
Dorner's
different,
right?
Truck.
Yeah.
But it's an example of how edgy everybody was. These are highly trained, theoretically, LAPD officers opening fire on a pickup truck containing two women without even identifying who was actually in it. It's an example of how nervous law enforcement was.
Heard a series of shots, two sets. One set was like four or five, maybe six, and then the second set came a little bit afterwards, and there were too many to count.
And it was two women delivering newspapers.
Yeah, two who, by the way, got millions of dollars later
in
a lawsuit, which is a separate issue. But and some of the best minds at the LAPD and law enforcement, instead of focusing on how to catch this guy, were focused on how to protect everybody at the same time. It was just a huge drain on resources, not an unlimited number of people available, you know, to work this kind of thing. So, like we were saying, you had sort of two things going on at the same time, protecting the potential victims and then trying to catch this guy and then trying to keep the public relatively calm, and then also trying to control the news flow because it was very difficult to get accurate information from the from the police department as news reporters, partly because it was a very fluid situation and partly because they didn't really necessarily want a lot of information out there.
Well, there was so much happening at once when you think about it, Phil. Remember, there was the incident where an eagle-eyed passerby saw somebody at a gas station that he thought, oh, I think that's Chris Dorner. He phones it in. So the officers, the two LAPD officers, go to and try to follow up, and indeed it is Chris Dorner. And remember, there's the firing of weapons. One of them is actually grazed. Then I think it's like 20 minutes later, Dorner gets away, but he ambushes the two officers at the stoplight. This is all happening in such quick succession.
And such over a wide area.
You
also
almost can't keep up with it. Yeah. It's at a dizzying pace. And you can imagine if you're the hunter and the hunted, this is a lot going on at once. And we as the media are trying to report on it. You almost couldn't catch it.
Police are not saying much, but this is what the spokesperson for the Riverside Police Department had to say just a short time ago.
We're still searching the area. This is still an active investigation. We don't know where the suspect is at this time, but we're making sure that this immediate area is safe.
And about halfway through, it got to a point where the sheriff in San Bernardino County was holding news conferences out there to try to help focus the information on this thing. It was a media I don't want to say a media circus, but it was a media.
It was a challenging time for everybody.
Right, it was
a challenging time for everybody, and their priority was to keep people alive and to catch this guy. It wasn't really to accommodate the news media in our demands.
Well, you guys hit it all right on the head. You're talking about Corona and Riverside and Irvine and Los Angeles, and so the story had tentacles in a lot of different areas beyond the city of LA.
Right.
In terms of, I'd be interested in Dr. Lieberman's thoughts. He may have been the ultimate terrorist. I mean, in terms of causing terror and panic and heightened hysteria, I don't think I've ever seen anything like that in those 10 days and the panic that ensued in law enforcement and outside.
Well, you know, as we've been talking, what this is reminding me of is the New Zealand terrorist who left a manifesto and ran from one mosque to the other. I mean, Christopher Dorner was longer and more places and so on, but there is kind of and they did call him a domestic terrorist. Some people called him that. But I think that this idea of fear, you know, the police becoming the hunted, I think it's that panic, in a sense, that ultimately determined how this whole thing came to an end. It was a frenzy because of all the fear.
It was warfare. It was militarized warfare. You had the police trying to find a guy who was a police officer that was weaponized.
Well, and remember, it was the winter. It was up in the mountains. The conditions were very difficult. And he had been there holed up for days, right? And there was a lot of discussion about, from the San Bernardino County Sheriff's afterwards, criticism of him. I said, you said you searched these areas. You searched these homes. How is it that he was able to hide out there? I said, well, we're not going to kick down doors if homes are empty. That was sort of an after-the-fact sort of report. But, yeah, it was – you didn't know where he was going to turn up.
Last night, investigators say he tried to steal a boat in San Diego.
SWAT teams descended on an apartment complex in San Bernardino after a report of another Dorner sighting.
Well, and adding to the hysteria, it was the mountains. Or was it San Diego? Or was it Mexico? We got sightings all over the place, and some of them were legit and some of them weren't. Mm. But that's the type of panic that had swept over the area.
Yeah, and nothing we'd ever seen like before like that, to my memory.
And to a guy who had felt so powerless, he was now exacting a huge amount of power over one of the most famous departments in the entire world, I think you can say, the LAPD logo known around the world because of television and Hollywood. So if this guy, Chris Dorner, this murderer, finally had this focus that went internationally, imagine the power he was suddenly feeling. We were talking about the fact of when the investigation headed up the mountain, and Beck said to me, as horrible as the whole period of time was, he said one of the very worst times was when Dorner went silent. Yeah. And he said, I said to myself, where is he and what is he doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is chilling.
One of the worst case scenarios when it comes to a search for a fugitive. You've got a forest where virtually every other foot there's a hiding spot, and you've got a fugitive who has expressed that he does not want to be taken into custody alive.
I think it's interesting, too, that you had a situation where a man who seemed out of control was very much in control. Because in the end, there were days where we had our news conferences in Big Bear or up in the mountains, and Dorner was a matter of feet away in a building. We didn't even know he was nearby. He could have killed us all. He could have taken – we had officers there. We had reporters and camera crews. He wanted attention. He could have blown everybody away on camera. And yet – he didn't do any of that. And at that point, he had already killed people. He's a cold-blooded murderer at that point. So how do you reconcile, Dr. Lieberman, the idea that he stalked people, he went after people, but then when there were people right in front of his nose, he held back. He maintained control.
Perhaps at that time he was thinking that nobody seems to know that I'm here. Maybe I'll go home and I'll be able to get away with it.
Did he want to be caught?
Well, that could be, too, you know, to be a martyr, like terrorists typically want. because he's his main thing. I mean, he and that was his intention from his manifesto. I'm not going to live through this. This is going to be my, you know, my last stand. There's no
last resort. Was last the title resort, of it, right.
Exactly. So I think that he figured that would make his manifesto and his points much more powerful if he gave his life. And, I mean, supposedly he did shoot himself, if that is all true.
Well, and I was just going to say, someone who is on the run, and you have all of Southern California and can go north or south or west or east, it seems like the most unlikely spot would be, let me go up to the mountain area where there's only kind of one way in and one way out and a very limited number of places where I could actually hide.
Right. And in fact, Bex talked about the fact, I said, was there ever a moment when you started to breathe a sigh of relief? He said, well, nobody slept during that whole period when I talked to him about what was going on behind closed doors at police headquarters. He said literally people were up like 36 hours and then you'd get a couple of hours sleep and do it again, which, you know, he wasn't complaining about. He was just describing the momentum and the adrenaline flow going on within the LAPD. But he said once they knew he was up the mountain, he said to himself, it's just a matter of time. We will get him.
Chief Charlie Beck, new interview 2019.
When San Bernardino became aware, you know, that he'd been holed up in one of the cabins, you know, near their command post, and we started to have sightings of him, you know, obviously, you know, that I knew that the end was near.
I think it's interesting and worthy to point out that this was a very unusual interview you had with Chief Charlie Beck. Since his retirement, I'm not even sure he's sat down with anybody for an extensive interview, let alone kind of go back over and look at what happened in that case. I don't recall him even while chief going into the kind of detail he went into with you. Was this a point where he just sort of felt like he needed to have a cathartic moment and sort of get this out of his system?
I actually don't think so. I reached out to him and it took a while for him to agree to do it. I think that it still is something that weighs on him. In fact, I know it weighs on him. He said he still thinks about it. He thinks about it every day. Could anything have been done differently? That his heart aches for the families who lost loved ones. And, you know, you can feel the weight of that burden upon him. So, no, I think he reluctantly talked to me. But once we sat down, he was open. It was a conversation that went on for over an hour. I think it was almost 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And he was very forthcoming. Later, investigations would reveal that his father was stalked by Dorner. Mm. And that came after they actually got into the cell phone and were able to look at information that was held inside of Dorner's
like
personal possession.
Like GPS information on where he had been.
Yes, that he had been stalking Charlie Beck's dad, that the plan was to shoot his father's dog first and then to kill his father. So you can imagine learning something like that about your loved one.
Chief Charlie Beck, new interview 2019.
It isn't so much that I felt hunted or that police officers felt hunted, because, you know, we all signed up for this. Every one of us, you know, is a volunteer. Every one of us chose this path. And we know it's a tough business. We know there's risk to it. You know, we know all of that. But our families, really.
We all know that the chief left a little bit earlier than the 10 years that he could have. Do you think this kind of was a weight he wanted to get off his shoulders? That he was do you think that may have had him leave a little bit earlier?
I never had that conversation with him, so I don't want to speak on his behalf without having that. At the time when I did his exit interview, when he left, it's been almost a year now since he left, he said it just felt like it was time. He retired on his 65th birthday, and that he was still young enough and healthy enough to enjoy himself. He has three grandsons, spends a lot of quality time with them. And you're right, we hadn't heard anything from Beck since his retirement. So to sit down for 90 minutes and to not put any prohibitions on me about what I could ask, I felt that it was a meaningful discussion.
Yeah, and congratulations to you for, first of all, reaching out and getting him to agree to do that, because people that might be listening to this out in the public, they think that, oh, that's just a routine thing. Oh, you call up Chief and, hey, we want to come down and do an interview. Chief Beck was not a fan of the news media. LAPD chiefs by nature are, you know, in the crosshairs. They feel persecuted. This was a very big black mark on the LAPD, and he is the LAPD. Remember when he was retiring, that's what he talked about. And you mentioned it, his dad, his kids. I mean, he is the LAPD. So this was a very difficult subject for him. So to be able to sit down and be open and candid with you, because I know you have a relationship with him professionally, obviously, and I think that it's great that you're able to do that. And I would personally like to listen to the entire 90 minutes because, you know, when you're the chief of the LAPD, you are one of the most high-profile law enforcement officials in the world. And to go through this with the department's dirty laundry aired publicly in the most vile way hurts. And for somebody like Beck to open himself up for 90 minutes to talk about this, like you said, with no prohibitions, no handlers, no publicists, no filter, is incredible. I don't think a Daryl Gates would have done it. I don't think a Bill Bratton would have done it.
Chief Charlie Beck, new interview 2019.
He wanted to hurt us emotionally and as well as physically. And, you know, I'm sure Randy would say it, and I know I would say it. You know, take me, you know, not my daughter. And so I think that's, you know, that's even worse. That's even more horrific. You know, it's even more monstrous. And you know, I hope nobody has any illusions about what kind of person this was. He was a monster.
Well, thank you, Phil. I appreciate that. He did say one thing, that his concern was that it would open up the wound again for the families who lost loved ones. And he even turned to the camera at one point and said, Randy, if this opens it all up for you again, I'm sorry.
Randy Kwan.
Yes, he met Randy Kwan. You know, he's a people who don't know Charlie Beck that well, and as Phil just pointed out, I know him professionally. I've interviewed him at least a half a dozen times one-on-one. I have always found him to be very forthcoming and a deep thinker. He cares so much about the LAPD, partially just because he spent his whole life in it, and it was a dream job to him, and it's something that's in his DNA is how he describes it. And you get that sense when you're around him and his family that this is their life's work. They consider it a calling.
Well, you know, he might well have realized that the LAPD did screw up because it wasn't under his watch. It was Chief Bill Bratton who fired Dorner, and all of this, you know, this Board of Rights and all of that was during Bratton's time. So then he inherited all of this. And I think he might have, you know, maybe he did look at it and did realize, you know, we screwed up. But he was sort of in a very difficult position because he wasn't the one in charge at that time.
Well, and plus, by the time you're hearing about Chris Dorner, it's an emergency. Mm. It's not like you get a call and say, hey, we've got this officer who has some concerns about the department who'd like to come in and discuss it with you.
Right.
He's killing people. So the dynamics of the situation, we can never forget it, even though on one hand, you know, you always want to be analytical as a journalist. You always want to be even-handed in how you look at a situation. But this was a crisis. This was not a fireside chat. Everybody, boots on the ground. How are we going to get this guy? What will stop him? Charlie did say, Chief Beck said, at one point, I said to myself, he'll either be taken into custody, killed in the commission of taking him into custody, or he'll take his own life. And he said, quite frankly, I thought that he would take his own life all along.
And there was this incredible sense of, this can't be happening. Incredible sense of disbelief. I mean, how can a guy do this? How can a guy go from being a protector, an officer, a guy proud of wearing a badge, to a what in effect is a badge of dishonor? How do you get there? I think Phil made a comment earlier before we started talking. How do you get from 0 to 60 like that? Where's the trigger that says, I'm getting the gun, I'm doing it? I know there's a history. I know he may have been bullied as a child. Maybe he wasn't. Maybe he was. But I know that it goes to the roots of his life. But where is that thing that's, historically, where is the thing that says, I'm getting the gun and I'm going after it?
Well, I think when he exhausted all of his appeals. I mean, he was fired in 2009, and this was happening in 2013. So he had time to sort of, you know, do the appeals and mull it over and just get increasingly enraged.
And it seemed that he felt cornered, trapped.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I know that he blames his being fired from the LAPD for his being let go from the Navy. That was very meaningful to him. He really valued. And he had got, see, that was the thing. He had gotten all of these medals when he was in the Navy. He was like a prize Navy man. And then it was such the opposite in the LAPD.
Based on his reputation with officers, he had a tendency to let his emotions get the best of him. And, you know, if you're a police officer, that's going to get you in trouble. And if you just say the hell with everything, step over the line and start killing people, that's the point of no return.
So his outward persona was being systematically dismantled. The things that he valued. I mean, if you went around this table and asked any one of us about how we want to be seen in society, we might say, you know, parent, husband, wife, daughter, niece, journalist, Christian, whatever, however we view ourselves. And if that one or more of those things is taken away, it becomes an emotional trigger. Now, someone who has coping abilities is not going to act out in a violent way, but it seems he viewed himself as being dismantled, his public persona dismantled. And when that last trigger happened, he lost it.
Yeah, I think that's a good word, dismantled, to try to understand it. And clearly this was a man who didn't have, and again, partly because of things happening in his childhood, or largely because of things happening in his childhood, his sense of identity was compromised to begin with. And he was adding, you know, I'm going to be an LAPD officer. I'm going to be in the service. I'm going to win medals in the service. All of these things were really, he felt very small inside. And all of these things were, he put on himself to try to be important and to try to be somebody and to have an identity. Because then that goes back to where he says he wants his name back.
This is a necessary evil that I do not enjoy, but must partake and complete for substantial change to occur within the LAPD and reclaim my name.
Which strikes me as ironic because he destroyed his name. The name Dorner now is forever, you know, scorned. So when he talks about all he really wanted was to get his name back, I guess at some point he realized that wasn't going to happen, at least in his mind. So this is, as we've said, was his last resort. So he's saying one thing, but he's doing something else.
Do you all remember the picture that, in fact, it was seen around the world of Dorner smiling with then-Chief Bratton?
He was always smiling.
Right.
Every time you saw an image of him, he had a big smile on his face.
And I told you, I asked like three people who knew him personally, and they all said the same thing, really a charming guy. As I said, you know, we envision a rageaholic, like when somebody exhibit signs of road rage. They're usually fuming. You know, you can see the veins in their neck. They don't describe Chris Dorner that way.
Well, Dr. Lieberman, do you hear that? You hear that a lot, though, about people that have turned into, you know, notorious criminals. I'm working on a story about Lonnie Franklin, the Grim Sleeper, right now for our 70th anniversary series. And you talk to people that knew him, they were in shock. Charming, ladies' man, glib, life of the party, funny. And then they have a secret life.
Well, you know, I think part of this has to do with the fact that he didn't necessarily see himself. You know, you were saying that his name is in infamy. But I think in part he was thinking that he was sacrificing himself to bring everybody's attention to all the horrendous things that were going on in the LAPD to help people, minorities in the future. To make sure that this nepotism and favoritism and racism and all of that doesn't continue to go on. So it wasn't, you know, my name is going to go on one level.
You said it before, he's a martyr.
Yes, exactly.
Or how he viewed himself.
How does a guy who seemingly holds the job in such high regard, Phil, you used adjectives, you know, upstanding, I forget what the words were that he used to describe himself in the manifesto. How does that same guy go and ambush someone at a traffic stop, you know, and kill a Riverside police officer? How does he shoot a sheriff's detective exchanging gunfire with him? How does he leave another officer with, you know, 8 bullet holes and permanent damage, even though he survived it? How does this guy, who seemingly held such high regard for the badge, even though he had disdain for the department, be the same guy that somehow in his head justifies killing other officers?
Well, I think in those situations he was on the run and these people were getting in his way. And he, you know, he wanted to take his anger out at the LAPD anyway.
I think that was the thing I was asking a moment ago, and that was, yeah, this is unprecedented, really. I mean, how do you deal with this? What kind of orders have you been getting from the chief?
Most officers are going to be highly cautious of who follows them, you know, who's around them, cognizant of what this guy looks like and the vehicle that he's driving. Just be highly sensitive of your surroundings.
If he were alive and had survived and you were called as a court-appointed psychiatrist to evaluate him before trial, what kinds of things would you talk to him about?
I always start with the person's childhood because that's where the seeds of whatever it is that they did are sown. And
you see commonalities in that of lack of love or support or...
Abuse, bullying, often no father... fatherless homes, sometimes, you know, rather severe abuse. Everybody's a little different, but there are definitely in everybody's case who does go on to do atrocious things, there are atrocious things that start in their childhood.
Every time, in your experience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Which is interesting because I can understand that. It's almost a little... trite, isn't it, that you have a problem that must have started in your childhood. But I guess there's a truth to that. And the other thing is, if he was bullied, if he was mistreated as a child, oftentimes you build defenses against that. You don't shrink even more, or you don't become violent. You try to become bigger, right? You try to become somebody who can defend against that sort of thing. You don't become the offender.
Well, it depends. So there's a thing called identification with the aggressor. And so some kids, when they are either bullied on the schoolyard or bullied by a parent, you know, physically abused by a parent, they sometimes identify with the aggressor, meaning that they realize that the aggressor is the one who has all the power and they feel helpless. So then they grow up to want to be like the aggressor. But, you know, he was sort of flipping from one to the other. He grew up to try to be the aggressor, but in a socially sanctioned way, in a socially right. acceptable way by being a policeman yeah. and being in the Navy.
Well, that's what I find so fascinating about him. You know, when you look at that picture of him standing with Bill Bratton, then the police chief, and they're holding up the medal, that this is what they do often when someone's been serving overseas in the military, and then they come back to the LAPD. Several police chiefs have done this, where they bring them into the front office. You're in the chief's office. This is obviously a big deal in your life. You pose with the picture, and then you're given that photo. Now, when we interviewed Bratton on the air live, I asked him if he had any personal memory of that event, and he said, no, but this was typical of what we did. He said, you know, obviously I remember that I did it with many officers who returned from active duty, but I don't in particular remember Chris Dorner. But it seemed like this was a guy who wanted accolades, who wanted to be accepted by society, and then he does the most antisocial thing you could ever do with your life.
Well, I would tell him to turn himself in. You know, this has gone far enough. You know, nobody else needs to die.
So let's take it back to Big Bear. Now you have this guy who's on the run. He, at this point, has shot a couple of officers, killed an officer, killed a couple. He knows the entire world is hunting for him. And he goes up to Big Bear, one of the most popular, you know, resorts down here in Southern California. Huge family destination, especially in February. And really, for a couple of days at least, hides in plain sight in the middle of everyone. What do you think that was like, Doctor? And what was he thinking when he was hiding out in the middle of everything?
Well, I have come across something that said that he went to Big Bear because there was someone, J.Y., who was a family friend who had a cabin up there. I don't know more than that. But that's also why the LAPD thought to look for him up there, because they knew about this connection.
And he ended up, though, at one of the ski resorts, right? Mm-hmm. In a condominium.
Now, this all started here in Big Red about 9:30 in the morning when a passerby near the Bear Mountain Resort spotted the pickup truck on fire. He called 911, and first responders immediately saw something that made them think it was Dorner's car, and that's when we first got tipped off.
When we found a burned-out car, we knew the investigation was turning towards Big Bear. There were media up on the mountain, staying in that same ski resort where he was, because right. No one knew that he was there. And, you know, obviously the final rampage ended in a hail of bullets, but that must have been an amazing time. I wonder what he was thinking, even if he didn't come out of that cabin he was in. Because before he was in that cabin where the final shootout was, he was in this ski resort timeshare condo. I wonder what was going through his mind, knowing that everyone was hunting for him.
Would that be empowering to somebody with his psychoses?
Well, I think it would be two sort of opposing ways of feeling. One is perhaps empowered. Another is, you know, oh, man, they're getting close. Another is, I want to die to be a martyr. I mean, I think he was a mixture, a jumble of all kinds of emotions as the LAPD was closing in. But I wonder about, like, what was the LAPD thinking? You know, why did they finally resort, I know they tried other things first, but why did they finally resort to something that was would start a fire and would burn down the shed that he was in?
To be clear, there were smoke bombs, right? Tear gas.
That wasn't the LAPD at that point. Right?
By then it had moved to
Sheriff's Department.
Or the Sheriff's, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like the house is on fire there,
yes.
Kevin.
Yeah, the house was lit on fire. Reportedly, from the ground units, they were trying to put some gas into the house. It was also being reported that he was possibly throwing smoke bombs out of the house to try to distract those officers.
So the canisters, that was the start of the fires, right? Is that your recollection, Phil?
Yes.
Yeah, and well, it was never 100% clear because there was so much firepower there and so many things were fired into it, but that was the assumption, yeah.
And so it was a while before anybody even knew that there was a body in there. And at first...
It was days before they actually said that he was dead.
Right.
Remember?
Right, I do remember that.
Well, let me take you back to when this was all going down. And at the station I was at, we had a really unusual thing happen. Well, a lot of media were up on Big Bear covering this story. Our reporter, who was working for the local station and the network, they were in an unmarked vehicle, and they ended up behind a trail of unmarked law enforcement vehicles. They just knew that something was happening. They didn't really know what, and they were kind of waved through with everyone else. So our reporter ends up at the Dorner hideout, where law enforcement is staging, and a shootout starts. He can't get a live satellite signal from Big Bear. That's a little inside baseball, but the best form of communication with him was via phone. He and his videographer are hiding on the ground now as the barrage of gunfire is going back and forth, talking live to our anchor, trying to describe the situation. And all you hear is like that type of thing. Like you're watching, you know, Iraq war coverage on CNN. And the phone would go set dead, and then he'd whisper again, "Oh, we're back here. We're hiding right now. They're telling us to move back." And then you hear do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. A couple of times the phone just went completely dead. I mean, he's on a cell phone on Big Bear, and our anchor would be just – we'd just sit there. Another one of those things I've never seen before in TV, just kind of sit there and wait for word. And then, you know, he'd come back and be like, "We're here. We're hiding now. There's fire."
Because you didn't know even if he had been injured.
I didn't know. And
bullets flying everywhere.
It's also a very long helicopter ride. So when we start hearing that this is happening on Big Bear, I'm sure all the news stations are launching their helicopters. But there was a while there before we had any visuals. All we had was the phone. And then when visuals did start coming from the helicopter, then you started seeing a cabin on fire. And we didn't even really know what was going on there. We just knew that our reporter eventually was safe. And we knew that the cabin was on fire. And that this volley of gunfire had gone back and forth. It was the most amazing, bizarre, and intense time I think I've ever had in a newsroom control room, wondering how was our reporter, how were those law enforcement, was everyone safe? He ended up in a situation he certainly didn't know he was going to end up at, just by happenstance of taking the right turn versus the left and being kind of waved through with everyone else. I can only imagine what law enforcement was thinking as those final moments were closing in on everyone, and what Dorner himself was thinking as he sat in that cabin with all this happening.
We believe that Chris Dorner, the fugitive that's been on the run for about a week, who's gone on a murderous rampage, has met his fate inside this cabin.
I think he was a man on the run who was trapped, and he would do anything and everything to get away. And that's what you're seeing in his actions. Let us remember that he tried to carjack. Remember? He carjacked. Then authorities were pursuing him. He crashed the car. I mean, one of the things that Chief Beck said to me, he said, I think that he has been turned into a mythic figure, and I'd like to dispel that. Mm. He said it wasn't like he was top of his class at the police academy. Mm. He wasn't the best shot in his class. He wasn't a guy who was in special ops in the military. He had some training, but he said the biggest thing that he had was a cache of weapons, and he didn't care about the loss of human life. He ambushed people. So I think I would like to underscore that here today, to never lose sight of what Chris Dorner did to get his word out and how he did it.
Well, I don't think anybody, I agree. I mean, nobody should be or is trying to glorify this guy. But I think it was a remarkable period in Southern California history. And I think that, you know, probably learned a lot from this episode. I mean, I wonder if Chief Beck in your discussion ever talked about whether he should have ever been allowed into the LAPD, what kind of psychological testing they do and what that does or doesn't reveal about somebody.
Well, he said that he asked himself many times over, was there anything we could have done differently?
Chief Charlie Beck, new interview 2019.
I've thought about this, you know, long and hard, and you know, he went through the police academy, and luckily, the system, you know, that we use to determine whether or not somebody is suitable to be a police officer worked correctly and weeded him out.
But he clearly still thinks about it six years later.
The other thing is this guy, I don't know if schizophrenia is involved here, but he had two different faces. He had the face of the cop. He had the face of the guy that wants to protect people, that wants to be in the service of the country, that wants to be out there getting the carjackers and the killers and the bad guys. And that's exactly what his other face was. It was almost like the two masks for drama, two different people. Mm-hmm. Could there have been some schizophrenia involved in that?
Well, that's the...
Yeah, I know you wouldn't know without examining him, but...
I didn't mention that as one of the differentials, but of course, you know, yes, some psychosis, you could consider that. But he just seems, you know, he was 33 at the time that he died, and that is a little late to start showing signs of schizophrenia. That is more likely, you know, there's more likely the other diagnoses that I mentioned, the possible PTSD from his service, the manic depressive illness.
Bipolar? Could he be bipolar?
Well, yes, manic depressive, bipolar. He described himself in his manifesto as severely depressed, and then all these personality traits that he had, sort of mixture of personality traits. But I want to know, why didn't the sheriffs or whatever law enforcement, I know there was a controversy after this whole thing ended, why didn't they just wait it out? Like, here he was in a cabin, whatever food there might have been in there would be used up, and water, well, maybe not water.
You know, that's an excellent question, and that question is asked a lot in other scenarios. He opened fire on those sheriff's deputies, killed one of them. All bets are off at that point. They fired pyrotechnic tear gas canisters into the cabin, knowing it would likely set it on fire. I mean, the theory was it would maybe force him out. So it's the same thing in any police confrontation. They all will tell you, right, that the suspects dictate what happens. You're opening fire on us. We're not going to sit there and wait it out, even though that is a legitimate question that's often asked.
Do you know if the gas that was put into the house started the fire, or
did it start internally?
I don't know. And how much force did they go in with? Was it just gas they went in with, or other devices?
I don't know. It's an active situation, and they're not concerned about updating me with that kind of detail at this point.
And there was also a strong suspicion that he had booby-trapped where he was staying, remember? In a lot of the investigations, they thought that he had explosives.
Yeah, and they actually had cleared, I think it was a three-mile perimeter around that cabin. Yeah, I mean, the way it ended, to me, is also controversial. Because, I mean, look, you know, you kill us, you know, you're not walking out of here in most cases. So I get it, but... You know, the use of that, of those flammable tear gas characters, canisters. Imagine if that was like a quote-unquote regular house where somebody was, you know, barricaded, probably wouldn't have happened. But the way it ended, I think, is also controversial.
I don't know that there's anyone that's questioning their
Nobody's mourning Chris Dorner.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying, you know, that was very unusual.
Well, that's why I was saying before that I think it was the heightened fear that, you know, this has been going on for days. And I think, and the police were angry that their life was in danger, that he was shooting police and fearful. And I think that they wanted, I mean, if
they wanted to bring it to an end.
Yes. If there was a perimeter, and I kind of remember that they backed up, right, to give him more room. But if so, they wouldn't have gotten shot anymore, you know. So I don't know why they couldn't have just waited a month.
See, I think if someone of his victims' relatives are listening to this, they would be outraged that we're even giving this much time to discussing this guy. And I get that. But again, I go back to that question of, you know, what do we take away from all this? What do we learn from this? How do we make it better moving forward?
So here's what I'd like to do. Take a pause right now and come back and pick up exactly on that. Lessons learned through this whole thing. Should we even be discussing this? What's the chief tell Laura about this? And what are the lasting messages from this?
Footnote to part two. Law enforcement would later say the fire in the cabin was not intentional. As for Christopher Dorner, an autopsy would show he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. After episode one of this podcast series went online, Teresa Evans reached out to Fox 11 Los Angeles. We've offered Teresa Evans the chance to speak in depth and on the record, should she ever choose to do so.